Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting to you today from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Algonquin Anishinaabeg territory, also called Ottawa. This is a special episode of Beyond Barbarossa, because joining us today is Mike Croissant, author of Bombing Hitler's Hometown, a new book published on 26 March 2024. The book is the story of the last mass air raid on Germany during the Second World War. On 25 April 1945, more than 500 bombers of the U.S. 15th Air Force took to the air from their bases in southern Italy to bomb Linz, Austria, the town where Adolf Hitler had grown up. And they ran into far more anti-aircraft fire than their intelligence had led them to anticipate. The book is the story of the men, and yes, they were all men, on those planes, as well as some of the people on the ground in Linz that fateful day. One of the men in the air crews happened to be the uncle of author Mike Croissant of Illinois, and that's the connection that led to this book. I spoke with Mike Croissant a couple of weeks ago, only days before the book's release. I think you'll really enjoy our conversation. Hello, Mike. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Scott?
I'm doing well. It's a chilly day after we got used to some very warm weather for March in Ottawa. But you get used to it. As a Canadian, I can't complain about cold weather. It's not allowed. So before we get too deep into this, for the benefit of our readers, would you just tell us a bit about yourself and about your forthcoming book?
Thank you. I sure will. Well, my name is Mike Croissant. I'm from the state of Illinois in the middle of America, about 90 minutes away from Chicago, very small town where I grew up. It's called Marseilles. My connection to the war, to World War II, is through both my father and my uncle. My father, fortunately for me, had bad eyes and thus was kept in the United States. He did not enter combat, so he was stationed for the duration of the war in Delaware and New Jersey. My uncle, however, they were a family of eight. My dad was the oldest. My uncle was the next oldest, and they were very close. My uncle did go into combat. Specifically, he was a bombardier in the 15th Air Force, 459th Bomb Group. The 15th Air Force, of course, is one of two American strategic air forces stationed in Europe. One was the 8th Air Force based in England, and the other was the 15th, which was based near the spur of the boot of Italy. My uncle went through 21 combat missions without a scratch. The war ended and he came home. He was in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, essentially waiting to be discharged. And he got a short notice opportunity to hop on a plane and get pretty close to home. He would take the rest of the way home by train. So he got on the airplane and the plane crashed in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, he and everyone else aboard were killed. This happened in September 1945, not long after the war ended. Now, I went through my life. Now, this was long before I was born. I went through my life knowing about my uncle and about his early tragic death. And late in my father's life, I got him talking about my uncle more, and I got my aunts to both write to me and talk about him with me. Eventually, I acquired his letters, most of the letters that he wrote home during the war, and I used those to piece together the bombing missions he went on. And having an analytical mind, I approached each mission that I came across with a number of questions. You know, why did the 15th bomb that target that day? Is there anything historically or strategically significant about that city, et cetera? So I come to Linz, Austria, which was the mission on April 25th, 1945. And incidentally, that would go on to be the last mass bomber raid of the war in Europe. That's how I got the subtitle of my book. I looked into Linz, and what do you know? I sure didn't know. It was the town that Adolf Hitler considered his hometown. Hitler spent essentially about nine of his first 18 years in Linz. He went through adolescence there. It was his first exposure to German nationalism. It was a largely German city. Some of the key formative events of his early life happened there, including the death of both of his parents and his baby brother. And we get some glimpses into the early Hitler through primarily a book by one of his only friends in life named August Kubizek. Hitler, especially after he dropped out of school, would spend his days strolling about the city, sketching in a sketchbook. He loved the town, and on the other hand, he hated a lot of the architecture, and he wanted to remake the city. So we're going to fast forward to March 1938. Hitler is now the Chancellor of Nazi Germany, and he enters Austria at the head of a conquering army. He stops at the grave of his parents and then makes a beeline for Linz. And there he is treated to a wild reception in the town square. He gets up on the balcony, which is still there today, untouched, and he gives a chilling address, kind of seeing himself as the prodigal son. And the crowd goes wild. Both Hitler and Goering, who is listening on the radio from Berlin, decide, based on the reception he receives, to go ahead and annex Austria. And we all know what happened after that, and not long after World War II followed. So Hitler quickly sets about changing Linz fundamentally and remaking it as the cultural capital of Europe. We know that he would soon be sending his minions through the four corners of Europe to steal precious works of art. Well, all that artwork was going to go in the Führer Museum in Linz. He would construct this museum. He would construct a mausoleum for himself and for his parents and remake the city into sort of a Rome on the Danube. Now, in order to do that, he had to pay for it. So he industrializes the city to build tax revenue. The entire eastern part of Linz becomes an industrial center, including the Hermann Goering Works, which would produce steel and chemicals at first, and then later weapons of war. To go with that, a large rail system would be built. As I said, it's on the Danube River. Linz is on the Danube River, so there would be production of naval craft as well. So combined, the industry, the rail aspect, and the armaments production, Linz becomes a target of the 15th Air Force in July 1944, and it would be bombed 22 times. The last mission, April 25th, 1945, is the subject of my book. It would be the last time a massive force of bombers would be sent by the Americans to a target in Europe, and the targets were the Linz rail system. This was very problematic because in April 1945, specifically April 12th, Vienna fell to the advancing Russian armies. Before that happened, the Germans were able to pull many of their anti-aircraft artillery guns from Vienna and place them in Linz. I have intelligence reports used in the intelligence briefing the morning of the mission, which talk about how the city is roughly 50% better defended than it previously had been. And even before this, Linz was known as one of the worst targets for the 15th Air Force. The Germans defended it fiercely. There would also be a projection of a major German fighter response. That part turned out not to materialize, because the Luftwaffe was mostly grounded by that time by lack of fuel and pilots. However, the anti-aircraft threat was very real, and the men were shot to pieces. So that's a long-winded answer to your question. What caught my attention about this mission on this day was the numerous accounts that I found doing research about it on the internet of veterans talking in unit newsletters or in unit histories about how horrible this mission was. What they faced was unlike anything that any of them had seen before. And that set me down the road. I eventually interviewed 55 survivors of the mission at the end of their lives, at a point where many of them were finally willing to talk about it. Many of them had never spoken of it before. And yeah. I also did extensive archival research. I obtained numerous diaries and memoirs and other unpublished sources, spent a lot of time in the U.S. National Archives. And I was able to put together a pretty compelling story of not only the mission that day, but also how the men who were shot down survived, how they got through it. And then in the back part of the book, I addressed not only my uncle's death, but the struggles that many of the airmen faced after. You know, PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, was not recognized for the most part in those days. But I think, you know, I'm not a doctor myself, but many of the men suffered from it for years to come. And I deal with all of that in the book. It's essentially a love letter to the men on the mission.
Okay. That brings up so many different questions and too many avenues to go down. One, I'm going to just sort of mention this. One thing about advancing on the enemy, and especially in Germany and Austria in 1945, as the Soviets came from the east and the Western Allies came from the west, what it seems to me was that happening was the Germans were able to concentrate their defenses more. So did that play into that increased defensive posture or number of anti-aircraft and other defenses in Linz, the fact that they had been spread out wider and they're drawing back toward a more centralized area?
That's absolutely it. And the intelligence reports say that. They describe Linz as the hinge of German defenses in southeastern Europe.
Right.
I neglected to say earlier that not only was there a huge rail system, but that rail system was practically overflowing. There were about 2,000 rail cars sitting there. Whether there was actually anything in them or not, don't know. But this was an unprecedented number of rail cars there. And it was quite clear that needed to be taken out.
Yeah, I think that's something that a lot of people today especially don't appreciate. It's just how dependent, how critical rail infrastructure was in Germany's war effort, and how much of a difference it could make. When I cover the Eastern Front, that's a key part of it, is the fact that the Germans and the Soviets used rail extensively up to, you know, the last few miles, I suppose, at which point they wanted to use trucks, but they were actually quite dependent on horses and horse-drawn wagons.
Mm-hmm.
So now another question that comes up immediately, what was the total number of bombers? You mentioned in your book, there were a lot, all the different formations of bombing command that took part in it, but how mm-hmm. many different bombers were there? There were the B-17s and the B-24s, but.
Sure. This was a full force effort. They would send up 548 bombers.
Wow.
For the 15th Air Force, the 15th was largely outfitted with B-24 Liberators. It was about two-thirds Liberators, one-third B-17 flank fortresses. That proportion was reversed in the 8th Air Force in England. The Italy-based force was mostly Liberators. So they sent 548 of those up. 32 would turn back for mechanical reasons, and there would be 200 escort fighters. So we're talking about just north of 700 aircraft in the sky. And that's nothing to, you know, shake a stick at. That's a large force.
That's an immense force. You just think about that many airplanes in the sky at the same time. Now, of course, they were not altogether, they were in a successive waves. So how long would it have taken the various waves of from beginning to end to pass over Linz?
Ultimately, the trail of bombers was over 100 miles long, and the raid would go on for over 2 hours.
Right.
Not constant. There would be, you know, pauses as the formations would develop some distance between them on the flight up, but it was over 2 hours of punishment dealt out on Linz.
Right, right. And just for quickly, do you have the casualty figures either on the ground in Linz on the German side and on the American Air Force side?
I do. 15 aircraft, 15 bombers were shot down, mm-hmm. which was a large number for at that point in the war.
Mm-hmm.
28 Americans were killed. I'm sure many more were wounded. I don't have that figure. On the ground, I'm sure this figure could be disputed. It may not be accurate, but contemporaneous reports show 360 Austrians died.
So yeah, it was a massive operation.
It was huge.
I have some more questions for you, but first, let's take a short break.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more about my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and traditions. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks. Thanks, listeners, for coming back. And thanks to you as well, Mike. Now, you know, my podcast is dealing with the Eastern Front, focusing on the Soviet forces and their clash with the Germans on the Eastern Front. So we are at April 1945. First of all, it doesn't seem like this when I read the book, but I'll let you explain this. To what extent was there any either coordination, cooperation, or just awareness of where the Americans and the Soviets were? Did the Americans in the 15th Air Force know how close the Soviets were? You know, they're just across the Adriatic in some senses. They've taken Vienna. Did the flyers know how close they were?
The intelligence reports do talk about the fall of Vienna, the advance of the Soviet forces. There were a number of airfields listed by name in the intelligence documents of places the men could try to land at. On the Soviet side, though, I am not quite sure. There was one case in particular when a damaged bomber was approaching a Soviet-held airfield, and they scrambled fighters and looked to be on a strafing run against our bombers when a couple of our P-38s showed up and chased them off. So whether they would have come to blows, I don't know. But the flow of information on the Soviet side was much less than on the American side. I can say that for sure.
Yeah, that flow of information was pretty, it was not up to Western standards throughout the war, that's for sure. For the flyers, when they're going up, and of course, they had to know that there was a possibility that they'd get shot down, they might escape, they might parachute out, as a number did. What was their understanding of the possibility of aid from the Soviets? Was it like, well, here's our allies, or is it like, no, stay away if you can?
It was the former, as far as I can tell. They were directed to give themselves over to the Soviets if necessary. The men all carried an ID card that, not a card, but sort of a thing you could unfold that had various languages that the men would likely encounter if shot down. There would be Polish, Hungarian, Russian, and each translation would be the same thing in English. I'm an American soldier. Please render me back to American authorities and give me assistance. They all had that in their possession. One particular case that I'm sure will shock many people was Dale Shabelsky. Dale was a radio operator in the 456 bomb group, very close to being done with his combat tour. He had 33 missions under his belt. He had two more to go before he could go home. Unfortunately, the Germans had something to say about that. And over Linz, Dale was wounded in two places, and his aircraft was knocked out of the sky. The pilots were able to make it to Hungary. They didn't quite make it to one of the Soviet-held airfields, but they did crash land in a farmer's field. Hungarian partisans quickly approached the aircraft. They took away the members of the crew who were uninjured. They took Dale and separated him from the tail gunner who had also been wounded and gave Dale medical treatment and then proceeded to, through hand gestures, there was no common language. They communicated to him to surrender his American uniform and his identification papers and don Hungarian civilian attire. He did that. He kept his dog tags and his 45, and they made their way to Budapest. And in Budapest, Dale gave himself over to a Soviet patrol. Now, Dale Shabelsky is of Polish and German extraction, and he
That's
does
great.
look like he's a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, pale-looking young man, very, very young. And the Germans begin to first beat and then torture him because they think he's a German spy.
The Russians, you mean?
The Russians do.
Yeah.
And he is tortured for a number of days before finally being handed over to American authorities in Odessa in the Soviet Ukraine.
Yeah. How long was he under Soviet capture, captivity?
I haven't been able to put an exact number of days on it. I just know that it was at least a week, probably more.
Now, was he one of the men that you spoke with?
I did speak with Dale once. Dale suffered for fairly obvious reasons for many years with nightmares and other setbacks because of his treatment. He did later in his life, at his daughter's urging, start to open up about his experiences. He wrote a memoir that I was given access to. He started to do interviews. And through all of those things, I pieced together his story, and it's by far the darkest episode in the book, and it's enraging the way they treated him.
Yes.
But Dale, to his credit, I think as a common from a combination of his Christian faith and talking about it, he was finally able to find peace near the end, I believe. He passed in 2014 at age 89.
Well, yeah, that's, it's kind of, it's heartening to think that, first of all, he survived such a heroic, horrific treatment at the hands of the Soviets. Now, when you encountered that story, did it surprise you? I must say that I, reading that account, I was shocked at just how brutal the treatment was, but sadly, not surprised. What was your reaction?
That was my reaction as well. You know, we didn't talk about this yet. I am a retired CIA officer, and I've come to know the Russians quite well as a people over my career. And between that and the reading, I got a pretty good sense for how they deal with people they consider their enemy. Mm-hmm. So yes, I was shocked, but not surprised.
Mm-hmm. I did want to get to your work experience at some point, but let's get into it now, since you mention it. Do you feel that your experience, I don't know what you did in the CIA, and probably you can't tell me, but do you think that it helped you as a historical researcher?
It absolutely did. You know, I believe that we're all, each of us individually has a gift or something they're meant to use, excuse me. In life, I learned fairly early in life that if I had one, it was the written word, that I could tell a pretty good tale in writing. I started writing stories when I was in middle school. Now, when I began working with the CIA in 1999, I was an analyst. The analysts are the ones who take all source intelligence, that is intelligence gathered from all sources, be they spies, be they communications intercepts, satellite imagery, et cetera, take all of that and form a picture of the story that needs to be told to the American policymaker. Mm-hmm. Doing that for all nearly 22 years, both as an analyst and then later in counterterrorism, I probably wrote thousands and thousands of pages of reports and reporting cables. So those skills, not just in the writing, but in the research, definitely came in handy. And I approached it in many ways, approached the book as an intelligence officer seeking answers.
Mm-hmm.
So those skills benefited me greatly.
So you spoke, I mean, yeah, you mentioned you did a lot of archival research. How many of the people mentioned in the book did you actually have a chance to speak with personally?
I spoke with about 55 survivors, and wow. not all of them ended up in the book, unfortunately. It was a much larger work than the one that's going to be hitting the bookshelves. But these men were all in their late 80s at the time. Mm-hmm. I started in about 2012 to do interviews. I talked to almost all of those men within just the first few years of this project.
Right.
I continued contact with several of them, and I just lost my very last man that I became close with about a year ago.
Well, I'm sorry to hear
passed
that.
Passed away. Thank you. But I became quite close with several of them. Some, mm-hmm. in some of the interviews were just a quick phone conversation. But for many, I got very close with and had detailed, heartfelt talks. I had a couple men tell me they had never spoken of the mission or even indeed of the war with anybody else but me.
Wow.
And I'm grateful for that. And I felt a burden of responsibility to get it right. So I put a lot of effort into getting the details right, not just of about them, but of what they wore, what, you know, their missions on the, what their roles on the bombers were, what, mm-hmm. what they saw and smelled and felt. I tried to get all that right with as much accuracy as possible.
And it really shows. It really does. Mike, I have so much more to ask you, but I'm going to have to pause now. Listeners, this has been part one of my talk with Mike Croissant, author of Bombing Hitler's Hometown, The Untold Story of the Last Mass Bomber Raid of World War II in Europe. Join us again next episode for the rest of our really fascinating conversation. Patreon supporters get early ad-free access to every episode. So if you can't wait to find out what comes next in our conversation, just become a Patreon supporter. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa or go to beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com and click on the Patreon button in the banner. Mike Croissant's book is called Bombing Hitler's Hometown. It's available in hardcover and ebook formats from all the regular e-tailers, as well as in better bookstores everywhere. I've put a link in the show notes and on the webpage for this episode. I've posted a review on my own website, writtenword.ca. Just click on the blog button when you go to that site. I've also posted a direct link to the review in the show notes. Thank you all for listening to another episode of the first and so far the only English language podcast focusing on the Eastern Front of World War II. Don't forget to follow Beyond Barbarossa in your podcast feed so that you don't miss the next episode. I also want to take a moment to thank all who have supported the podcast through Patreon. It really helps make a difference. And if you are a Patreon patron right now, why not mention the podcast to your friends who are interested in podcasts and history? If you're not a patron so far, you can become one at any level that is comfortable to you. Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Also, why don't you consider following Beyond Barbarossa on your preferred podcasting app? Or if you like this episode, leave a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, Podbean, or wherever you listen to podcasts. That really helps improve the ratings for the show and spread the word to others who might be interested in this topic. If you have a comment or a question, or if, touch wood, if you find I've made an error, why don't you let me know? You can reach me by email at contact@beyondbarbarossa.ca or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burry. I'm Scott Burry. Until next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraina.